He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
Maybe I am a designer. I think it depends on what you consider a designer and what design means to you. Like, you know, we design our lunch every day. We design our schedule. Like, everyone is a designer in that sense. I think I hesitate to call myself a designer because of the design community and what those expectations are. And I don't think that I meet them. I suck at typography. I don't use grids. You know, I think in my head when I hear design or designer, I think graphic designer, then I think like what that traditionally means. And this is probably my own, you know, like limited thinking and limited belief. And like, oh, a designer can be more than that. Like, I know that it's easy for me to see it, but not in myself, I guess, if that makes sense.
Sometimes you see someone's work or you find a studio that just resonates with you. It might be the color choices. It might be the way something animates. It might just be the music or the composition that the studio seems to use over and over and over in their projects. But you find that one shop or that one artist that you just want to know more about. Back when I was getting started in motion design, there was one place that I went to every day online to see if they post any work. And that was Three Legged Legs. And one of the principals of that studio was a guy that you may have heard his name. Greg Gunn, who now works for The Future, had this little shop called Three Legged Legs that you can still go to the website and see it. But every single thing that Greg touched just seemed like it was infused with this crazy sense of energy and a really strong sense of design fundamentals. And I've always wanted to talk to Greg about how did design become such a big part of your toolkit and how do you use it even today? Well, now I'm going to get some of those answers. Join me as I talk to Greg Gunn. But before that, let's hear a little story from one of our School of Motion alumni.
I've been working on motion design for the last 10 years, but I thought it was about time to refresh my skill set. So I took the advanced motion methods with Sander. I really enjoyed pulling the lessons and I found the community super supportive. And I was amazed by the talent that some of my colleagues had. And overall, I found it like a very, very amazing and enjoyable experience. Quite challenging, to be honest, despite being an experienced motion designer. The exercises are quite demanding, but it's great. It's a great way to refresh your skill set and level up your career. So I would recommend School of Motion to anyone. Hi, my name is Mark, and I'm a School of Motion alumni.
Motioneers, there's two words that describe our industry. One's motion. We all know it. We all love it. We set keyframes. We push curves. But that other word, design, does that word scare you? Does that word intimidate you? Are you not even really technically sure what it is? Well, you're not alone. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring one of my favorite, I don't know what to describe him, creative directors, designers, animators. I've seen the phrase splendid weirdo a couple of times to describe Greg. But that's who we have to hear today. Greg Gunn is one of my favorite people working in motion design. And I want to bring him in just to talk about his origin story, to talk about design in general, and to tell you about something that he's got going really soon that's really special, something that I'm actually going to hopefully take part in as well. Greg Gunn, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, thanks for having me. I love that you open with like, let's talk about design, and then you bring me on the show because I would not consider myself a designer.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because I, you know, in this research, I went to your website and I was like, oh, he lists himself as an illustrator. He lists himself as an animator. But I literally think of in the world of motion design and, you know, character-based stuff, whether it's character or dealing with color, one of the people who has legitimately inspired me the most and taught me a lot and even in person kind of gave me a light bulb moment for how I think about color has been you, Greg. So it is interesting. I feel like you're almost the perfect person to talk about how we use design as a tool. We, you know about all the principles, but we're very cautious at ever even calling ourselves designers. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on.
Okay. I'll bite. Let's go. Let's talk.
You seem skeptical, which is interesting. So let's talk a little bit just about like your origin story. You know, like, there are so many paths into what's now called motion design, but I wonder if even back when you and I were getting into it, we even knew that phrase. I just, you know, thought of like commercials or motion graphics or I knew MoGraph from MoGraph.net, but how did you find your way like into this weird kind of mix of so many different industries? Like, what was motion design for you when you were getting started?
I think I was with you. I had no idea what motion design was. Like, I went to Otis College of Art and Design here in Los Angeles, and I went there to study graphic design. That was my goal. Mm. I liked making rave flyers and designing flyers for my own band. And I was like, maybe I can like make some money doing this. So I did that. And while at Otis, I took a few electives and I saw one about this program called After Effects. And I was like, what the hell is After Effects? And once I saw what it could do, I was like, oh, this is basically graphic design, but like animated too, or on a timeline. So I scrapped my graphic design classes and just switched to learning like basically After Effects and animation and stuff. And only then did I understand like that was an industry and it was its own kind of unique, weird little niche.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. For as much as at times After Effects gets derided as, you know, not being new enough or fast enough or robust enough, it really, for a certain generation, was the gateway drug that got us into this. It was the, oh, it's Photoshop with a timeline, that kind of like was the initial spark for so many people in the industry.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I didn't even know it existed. I was running like bootleg Photoshops trying to make flyers for my band. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what Director was, if anyone's old enough to remember that.
Oh my God. Macromedia. Even just the name Macromedia is a foreign concept now.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I was in school, you know, I was going to school for 2D animation specifically, you know, when that was still a viable industry to get into. And I remember I had a mixed media class and I didn't even know what it was. I just knew I had to take it. And I was excited because I'm like, oh man, this would be like painting and like collaging and all this different stuff. And I walked in and it was a computer lab. And I was like, oh, I must be in the wrong room. What's going on? And it was basically an After Effects class, but they had it listed as mixed media. Like, when was the last time you heard the term mixed media being used ever?
Like, when I think of art history, I think mixed media. I wish I was well-versed to like cite a reference here, but I don't have one. But I think at Otis they called it digital media. That was my major. It was digital media, which is like basically it was like some new shit and we don't totally know what to call it. And yeah, we're gonna teach you this stuff.
I feel like it's kind of interesting now because I feel like I talk about this a lot. There was that kind of MoGraph.net era where it was all Wild West, right? Like motion design or motion graphics was basically like, how do you just get something into the computer? And it could be photography. You could be building sets. You could do stop motion. It could be type. You could be hand drawing stuff and scanning it. And then it slowly turned into just like motion design equaled Cinema 4D plus After Effects for broadcast. And I feel like having gone to a couple of schools, we're kind of almost back into that like Wild West era of, oh no, motion design, we don't know what it's going to be or where it's going to go because of virtual reality, because of all the Web3 stuff that's coming out, because of, go ahead and take your drink right now, NFTs, like the world for what we can kind of like play in and what we can make is kind of about to explode. And it's interesting even just seeing schools trying to react to that the same way they were when we were starting out.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I've always been one to, I don't know, embrace the weird, new, unknown stuff. That stuff kind of gets me excited, even though I really don't understand most of it. I think it's all potential. So I don't know anything and I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm stoked for all of it. And hopefully I will get a chance to explore it too.
So you went to Otis and you discover that, you know, animation and motion is something that sits alongside. It's funny, you said you don't consider yourself a designer, but you started going to school specifically for design. I think that's a common story with a lot of people. I went to school for 2D animation. I barely ever do 2D animation anymore, but it got me there. So you finish school at Otis, you come out to this world, and then I don't know at what point like this becomes a thing, but I still, to this day, when people ask me, what's your favorite studio? Anytime I talk about, you know, all the regular ones, the Ordinary Folks and the Gunners and Buck and everybody else, I still always include Three Legged Legs in that list. And depending on my feeling at that day, it's like the top one or top two. And I legitimately, right before this call, every time I ever want to talk about Three Legged Legs, I cross my fingers that the website is still there. And it still is. But anyone listening to this, while you're listening to this, pull up threeleggedlegs.com and follow along, because That honestly was one of the studios that when I'm going through school, even when I first got in the industry, I'm like, one day I will work with Greg Gunn at Three Legged Legs. Can you tell us just a little bit of the story about, you know, like, how did this happen? Who were your partners? What was it like at what I'm assuming was a fairly young age running a studio that, from my perspective, being, you know, a couple of years probably right alongside or just behind where you were in the industry, as being like a shining light, like a place that people should want to be?
Oh man, that's a really big question. The very short answer is by accident. All of it by accident. But nice. Going back to sort of, you know, the Wild West comment you made and being in the right place at the right time, Three Legged Legs was started by myself, Casey Hunt, and Reza Rasoli. We all went to Otis together and we essentially just made a bunch of short films and were goofing around making stuff. And this was pre-YouTube. And in my days being in a band, making flyers and websites, I was like, okay, shoot, we need a website. We got to put our work up. Let's submit it to festivals. So we did that just to sort of like, you know, plant our flag on the internet, so to speak. And this sounds totally bonkers, but someone saw it and they were like, hey, do you guys want to direct TV commercials? And three of us were like, I guess, I don't know. Like, not really, to be honest, but we're about to have a lot of student debt, so maybe we give this a shot. So that is the very abridged version of how it was formed. And I think on the outside, like, we probably came off like a studio, but really we were just three buddies trying to make cool work and not be broke. That was the goal. There wasn't a like plan to grow or scale or hire people even. We did hire, you know, freelancers to take on, help us take on work and, you know, produce stuff. And we always just tried to hire our friends or like our friends' friends as much as we could. And that was it. The goal was to not be a studio, really. It was like, let's explore this commercial work. Try to make stuff that's really interesting to us and hopefully not go broke doing it.
I think that the phrase I'm going to say, I probably have already said it twice now, but the phrase I'm going to say the most while talking to Greg is ahead of the curve, because I still go to Three Legged Legs and I almost always, whenever I want to show people like a really cool project breakdown in terms of like where the idea came from, the process, the blind alleys you go down, and then where you come back and it still ends up with a really cool spot, is the Amp X Games spot that you guys did at Three Legged Legs. Because there's an energy about the animation. There's a certain amount of like, it has like this kind of, I hate using the term everybody says, but like punk rock kind of, not just aesthetic to the animation, but the feeling of like what it took for you guys to get there. Like, you're throwing a lot of things up against the wall and it seems like it was made fast. But because of that, it has this crazy energy that you don't see in motion design now. But as I scroll through it now and even just look at it, what also kind of like is really stark to me is that back then, Three Legged Legs was doing what I still feel like many studios struggle desperately at. Like you said, this was pre-YouTube, pre-Instagram, pre-Behance, you know, pre-people using LinkedIn to kind of like establish like your brand as a studio. But what you guys were always doing, I always felt like there was a sense of who the studio was just by when you posted a project, right? Like, I get a sense of who the people are. I get a sense of the energy inside the studio. I can see drawings. I can see ideas. I can see process. And even in the way the team wrote, it didn't feel, like you said, it felt like a non-studio. It just felt like, oh my gosh, if I needed a company to do something with energy that was playful, that was like gnarly, that had, you know, life, that felt like it had something, the hand of the artist in it, immediately, my brain always would go to Three Legged Legs, which is honestly, when I talk to studios now, when I meet with Joel Pilger at RevThink, these are the things that everybody's trying to do or looking for someone else to teach them how to do. And, you know, like, you can look through this and I can like, oh, I could see how I can almost even just see, oh, this is what your Instagram profile would have looked like if Three Legged Legs was built now, right? There's behind the scenes. There's all this great process work. There's drawings. There's stuff that didn't make it. There's photos of the team, you know, working. You're doing what most studios didn't even do back then and really don't do now. You're saying who worked on the project and giving out credits. Like, these are all the things that a lot of studios can't do or don't know how to do now that you guys had down back then.
Yeah, I've never thought about that, but I suppose you're right. It's I don't know. It just felt like we don't know what we're doing. So why not do this too? You know, it's like, let's just keep art school going and try to pay everyone along the way.
I mean, I love that mentality. And I feel like there's a possibility for there to be a resurgence of companies or groups of people like Three-Legged Legs, if it's not even already happening now, because the ability to learn this stuff, you know, obviously you work at the future. I work at School of Motion. The ideas are out there. The guide paths are there, but like the tools are so much easier, or at least plentiful, to be able to kind of like do this. Like, oh man, I really liked working with this student, or this other person in school. Let's see if we can make some money doing it. Getting your name out there, getting your voice out there, and finding a client is not as difficult as it was back then. Like, it's almost a miracle that you guys were able to find these agencies and these brands to work with. But tell me a little bit about how Three-Legged Legs kind of ended. I hate even saying it. Oh, it actually breaks my heart even saying ended. But like, how did you transition from being part of this collective and, you know, two other, you know, partners, and where did you move on to next? What was the next step?
Yeah, I think there's nothing wrong with something ending. I think that's perfectly fine. Essentially, you know, like I said, we just didn't know what we were doing, and we wanted to make fun work and say no to everything that wasn't fun. And that worked for a while, but you know, things change. People change, lives change, and the industry changed quite a bit too. I think we got started in 2006. And I also, like, one more reason that we were not a studio, I guess I could say, is we had a production partner, Green Dot Films, who I don't think they're around anymore, but they did all the sales and marketing. So we owe any sort of financial and commercial success to those guys. And without them, you know, we obviously wouldn't have any work. But around, you know, 2008, 2009, when the market crashed, the financial collapse, I guess you could say, everything changed in the industry, and we didn't see as many jobs. And the jobs we did see, you know, the budgets were maybe half of what they used to be. So I don't know, things got dicey, things got weird, and we're like, oh man, what do we do? You know, and the same goes for everyone else. Everyone was kind of like scrambling, like, oh right. My God, how do we survive this? You know? And we really didn't have a sort of financial or business plan for that. And I can't speak for, you know, the other guys, but I was like, man, I need work. I have to have to pay rent. Right. I have to do stuff. I'm a person. I need to like survive. So I started freelancing a little bit and just kind of taking on whatever work I could, you know, to pay the bills, to make sure I was still, you know, alive and supporting myself. And over time, it just kind of fizzled, you know, as things tend to do and shift and change. So at some point, I think it was 2011, before we disbanded, we moved from Green Dot over to Blind, which is Christo's design company. And we literally like moved down the street. It was like two blocks away. We like brought our three PCs and we're like, hey, we live here now. And essentially kind of like worked as a directing team under Blind. And we booked a few jobs through them. And that was cool. And I think that's where things started to sort of just fizzle a little bit, because I don't know that everyone wanted to keep doing it, you know, and especially not in the same way. So I think at that point we made a decision to disband and dissolve Three-Legged Legs, and I stayed obviously at Blind. And I started working as a creative director on staff with Chris at Blind.
Right. Well, I need to find a way to just like compile and save the entire Three-Legged Legs site, because it feels like it needs to be Maybe I'm three-legged legs number one fan. Maybe I just discovered that. But I need to find a place to be able to like still reference it and send it out to people. I mean, I know I definitely have right-clicked and saved all of the AMP X Games project. And I probably could put up the Behance page for that and reconstruct it. But it is a very interesting artifact of a time and of a place that, like you said, I think anybody who can remember working in this industry back around 2008, 2009, probably is a little gun shy and a little trepidatious of the energy that's going on right now in the industry, where everybody's like, there's too much work. I don't know what to do. I got to hire more people, find an artist. That like, I'm kind of still probably in that group of people that is probably like people who grew up during the Depression, where they're like, I can't believe that this is going to last. Oh wait, the bottom crashed. We have the experience. I wonder how much that's even affecting people's decision-making process now, because it feels like the sky's the limit, right? Like anything is possible, but I feel like on the same side, there's still that kind of crash that did happen in the past that it could be waiting anytime.
It could be. That's an interesting point. I thought about that too. You know, it could be some like PTSD from that era. Like I remember as a kid, when I was at my grandma's house, who did, you know, survive the Great Depression, she had this like giant cabinet in her garage, like floor to ceiling. And it was just filled with like cans of beans and tomatoes and crazy shit like that. And I was like, why, grandma? What is all this? It's like, just in case. I'm like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope I don't want to. Now we have plastic jugs of water in our basements. Yep. And who knows what else? Okay. Well, so you get to Blind, and I think your time at Blind is pretty well documented, right? Like the projects that you worked on and things that people like Matthew Encina worked on. And I'm sure you grew and you learned a lot, but what's really interesting to me is, again, here's another instance of being way ahead of the curve. You transition from Blind and probably what you were used to doing and had a lot of confidence in doing, using your skills as a designer and an animator and an illustrator. And you start finding yourself in this thing called the future. And I remember, I mean, I think I first met you actually when that was happening, when you're starting to do more of work there and probably doing some Blind work at the same time. But it always was very curious to me that like, oh man, here's this guy who I think is one of the best illustrator animators in the industry. And he's doing essentially like tutorials and kind of teaching people rather than just making. Like, what's going on? What is that like? Why is he doing that? What was going on in your head as that was, you know, it didn't happen overnight. You know, it didn't happen all at once. There wasn't a flip of a switch and all of a sudden the future is there. But what was that like being in a place where you guys were a powerhouse studio doing really killer work? I remember like when that Coldplay video came out, Blind was, you know, at the top of its game. And then all of a sudden there's this other thing coming out of that building. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was like the dark horse within the company. Yeah, I mean that in the best of ways. No, it was weird. It was, because to your point, I built a whole career on doing this thing. And, you know, slowly over time, Chris made the decision like, hey, I want to focus my efforts on the future. And eventually, you know, kind of Blind will not cease to be, but it'll sort of go dormant. And you're welcome to come with me. You know, I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I remember giving it some real thought, and I struggled with it, you know, because I think it did feel like, okay, well, I have to give up doing something I do truly love to do this other thing that I really don't know anything about. Who knows what this is going to be, what it means. I remember struggling with that decision of whether to, you know, take that leap forward and work with the future, or I guess, I don't know, not get left behind, but stay behind and keep doing what I'm so used to doing, what I really kind of built my career on, you know, like directing creative work, producing creative work, making creative things. But when I think back about, you know, all the decisions I'd made to get to where I was and where I am today right now too, I never just sort of like was like, go ahead, I'll stay here. You know, I always sort of just said yes. And I was like, well, let's see what happens. Worst case scenario, it like fails miserably and I can go back and find something else, you know? And I think that's a lot easier to do when you're younger. You know, you can sort of like take those risks and play the what if game without worrying too much about the repercussions. But it has served me well. And I've been very fortunate and very, very lucky in that sense too. So transitioning to the future, to answer your question, was scary. And it gave me some anxiety about leaving behind something I love to do and stepping into something I really don't know how to do, which is, I don't know, teach and share what I know and all this stuff. But I think I made the right decision. I'm very happy with that decision. And as it turns out, I didn't have to give up a whole lot.
I think it's really interesting that you describe it that way, because it reminds me, for myself and honestly, like for a lot of people we talk to at School of Motion who may be great animators or great designers, and they're used to kind of like ascribing their value for what they can do on the box. And then they get asked to art direct, or they may get an opportunity to be in the room with a client and kind of start creative directing. And it may not be as obvious as the choice that you were able to make, like with the future, but you do have that kind of like turning point challenge in our industry of, oh man, this is what got me to the dance and this is what got me to have this opportunity, but I'm kind of potentially walking away from everything I love doing and everything I know I'm good at to go and do things I've had no training for, right? Like I tell people all the time, so many students come out and say they want to be a creative director, but they don't really know what that means, you know, in terms of just like the day-to-day makeup of like what you actually do, right? There's a lot of writing, there's a lot of psychology, there's a lot of talking, there's a lot of thinking, there's very little like sitting on the box and doing what you already know how to do. And it sounds like that was a very similar kind of transition for you of like, wow, there's this mystery and I don't know how the stuff that I'm good at is going to necessarily apply to what I have to wake up every morning and say I'm good at doing now.
Right. Yeah, it's mostly emails. Let's not lie.
Emails and Zooms now. Lots of Zooms.
No, I think, you know, as a creative director, yes. Like, I think that is a weird transition. Not for everyone, you know. There's a lot I loved about it and there's a lot I didn't love about it too, you know. Transitioning to the future was an even like weirder one, you know, but yeah, it did come with some of that stuff.
Well, I have to say, I'm really glad you did. And I've had conversations with Christo where I've always said over and over, like, your guy's secret weapon is Greg Gunn. Like Greg is not utilized as much as he could be in terms of being on camera and talking to people in a way that is very empathic and a way that feels really true and really authentic. And I don't think there's a better example of what I meant by when I said that to Chris than honestly, what is one of my favorite things, top 10 things on YouTube ever, and I watch a lot of YouTube, is the series that The Future did called Design from Scratch. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what this experience was like. But if anybody hasn't seen it, definitely go to The Future and search Design from Scratch, or just search Greg Gunn's name on the Future channel. Because this is being recorded right after I watched the Beatles documentary Get Back, that I don't think you've watched it, Greg, but I know there's a lot of motion designers who have watched it. And whether or not you know the Beatles, you like the Beatles or whatever, there's something really amazing about watching this documentary with four of the best musicians, most high-powered band of all time in rock and roll, basically set the stage for something that no one else has even surpassed now, 40, 50 years later. But you get to watch these people as humans and you get to see them with their insecurities, with their failures, with their squabbles and the friction between each other, all for like a unified goal. And it was fascinating to watch. And immediately as I was watching, I was like, oh man, you know what I need to do? I need to go back and watch Design from Scratch, because it is, in my mind, for motion design, the closest thing to the Beatles Get Back documentary. But Greg, when I mentioned that I wanted to talk about this, you asked why. what was Design from Scratch like? Like, what was the intent for making this video that opens up this whole process? And what was it like for you going through it?
Great question. I think before I answer that, I'd just like to note for everyone listening that Ryan just made the comparison of me and some video series I made to the Beatles. So no pressure, but
no pressure. For me, you're the George.
Oh God. Okay.
In that. So anybody who's watched Get Back knows what that means, but go on, Greg. I want to hear more about what it was like for you.
Yeah. I asked why, because I'm like, that's so obscure. It's like, it's just some videos I made one
it's
time.
A Greg Gunn deep cut.
That's it.
We do our research here at School.
Yeah,
Motion.
Apparently. No, Design from Scratch. And it's been a while, so forgive me if I get some things wrong. Design from Scratch, I want to say it was like a 3-video series that we did on Future's YouTube channel. It was created, I think we had Webflow as a sponsor. And yep. We were also thinking about redoing our website, thefuture.com. And this kind of felt like, oh, you know what? That might be a good idea. Maybe we like document that. And then, you know, that can be like, it makes sense. It should be known, I'm not a web designer. I don't know how to do that. But I do know how to make videos. So I was tasked with telling this story and documenting it. And the goal was really like, okay, we have to make three videos that are sponsored by Webflow. They have to make sense. And while we're at it, let's start redesigning our website. So that was my plan. I was also tasked for some reason with leading the redesign of our website. And despite the future being as, you know, I don't know, I guess you could call it successful, or, you know, at the scale at which we appear, we're a relatively small group of people. And back then, an even smaller group. So yeah, long story short, I documented us trying to redesign our website, showing it to Chris and other people, and just like, I don't know, you get to see and hear it all. Like, people are like, I don't think it's very good. Missed the mark, you know? I remember, like, after it came out, feeling like kind of humiliated, you know, kind of like a fool a little bit. And it's silly because I'm like, well, Greg, you're the one that made these videos, you dummy. What do you, why'd you do that? Right. But it right. just seemed like, well, this is the story, you know? Yeah. And also a little bit of, oh my God, there is no story. So we have to like add some sort of like conflict to this video. Otherwise, this is going to be so boring. But, you know, YouTube is a fickle place, and YouTube comments are even more so. So it was, I don't know, man, to be honest, it was rough. It was really, really rough when those videos came out. I felt stupid. And that's okay, because, you know, I don't know how to make websites, and I probably shouldn't have made that website, and, you know, or at least let it. I don't know. But, you know, that was what we had to do, and we did, you know, that was the first, obviously, like, attempt at redesigning a website. The website looks so much better today. No thanks to me. But we did ultimately end up making a really, really great site. So kudos to our web development team. They did a great job.
I mean, I think it's, I mean, when you're in the middle of the storm, it's hard to be able to see outside of it or understand what it's doing. But for me, what was great about it is something I like to talk about all the time, is that motion designers aren't allowed to fail, or they're at least not allowed to show the process that they think was a failure, right? Like, everything in a post-social media, post content creator world, you know, even in a world where everybody's looking for as much content as possible, most people don't show and don't talk or verbalize failure, right? Or mistakes or anything like that. But for me, it was like, actually, I feel like I was benefiting from the pain you were going through. I was like, this is a revelation. This, like, to literally see a studio full of people who I respect and admire and see the process of them failing, right? Like doing the best they can, getting confused, getting lost, arguing, having something to submit, showing it to Chris, seeing him question it with clear eyes, right? From a different perspective. Like, that to me was kind of just like, oh my God, we're allowed to be human. Like, we're actually like allowed to make mistakes in a world where, like, you make mistakes all the time, right? People don't know the answers to anything. Like, our industry is so crazy because you wake up every day with a blank page or a blank screen, and you're paid, your value, your identity is based on your ability to fill that screen with something that another person will pay you to come back the next day and do it again, right? Like, the psychology of being a working motion designer, like, the things that go into it are kind of shocking that we don't talk about any of that. And this is the first time I had a place where I could point to and be like, look, like, it's hard. This stuff is hard, right? Like, eventually we will figure out the solution. Like, and that's why I compare it to Get Back, right? Like, you watch halfway through this and you're like, the Beatles are literally breaking up in front of your eyes because they don't know what to do next. And they don't know who the leader is. And they don't know where the good idea comes from. And they're so lost in the process, they can't even tell that they just wrote one of the best songs of all time on the piano in front of each other. And they're like, oh, this is garbage. We're done. I guess we have nothing left. And it felt a lot like what I felt like watching you do stand-ups to the camera, trying to explain where you're at. It felt so similar. I think it's, in my mind, it's almost like required viewing for people who are like, this is the industry you're about to get into. It's cool. It's fun. The end product is great. But this is what you can expect the process to sometimes be like.
You know what the difference is, though, Ryan? The Beatles wrote Eleanor Rigby. Then I got shit on in YouTube comments.
Well, you know what? I really wonder what the Beatles would be like if while they were on the fly recording any of their albums, people could watch a live stream and make comments about it. If Twitch existed when the Beatles were recording Sgt. Pepper's, everyone would have been like, these guys are awful. What are they doing? They've lost their edge. Like, there is something about like being able to like exist separate from the rest of the world for a brief moment when you're trying to be creative. But I think that's the big, that is a huge difference. I was reading a really good article about that documentary about how it's almost as much a point to like how messed up things are now as it is a cool document of the past, because they're like, everybody dressed either super cool or super like buttoned up. There literally are no cell phones. Like, people are, they cannot be distracted. Like, they have to sit in the room with each other, and there's no plastic anywhere. Like, people are literally being brought like tea and biscuits on like actual real plates with real cups. Like, it really shows how much, because we're in the boiling pot of water for the last 50 years, the changes were slow to happen. But when you literally go back to the past, to 50 years ago, it would be amazing to do the same thing and be like, oh, let's go to 1988 when someone's making a movie trailer or a movie title, or someone's creating a commercial for Sears, doing the same thing we're doing, same job title, same company, same expectations. How different the day-to-day would have been like back then versus now, and how the pressures are totally, totally different.
Yeah. No, a lot of, I struggle daily with distraction and trying to be in the moment. That's a totally separate conversation, but yeah, I get it.
Well, I mean, one thing I'd love to talk to you about, because I feel like we talked about a little bit and we've danced around it, but I always think of in motion design, so many people, like we were saying, come into the industry from radically different ways. And I think a lot of people come into the industry, like you mentioned, you were in a band, you wanted to make some posters. Some people are skaters. Some people watch cartoons. Some people read comic books. They all come in from different ways. But now, a lot of people come in straight through the technology, right? Like, there's a generation of people who played Roblox when they were kids, played Minecraft, started getting into Blender, started just like bolting on these tools and these techniques to be able to make an image completely devoid of the word design, right? Like, design did not enter their lexicon. They don't know the fundamentals. They haven't been introduced to any of it. But you could literally get a job in our industry easily without ever knowing, touching, or interacting with design at all. But I really think the superpower for a lot of people in our industry, the people who are at the top of the game, design is that secret weapon. How does design for you, for a person who I look at as an amazing designer, but literally, like we said on your website, you're an illustrator, you're an animator, you're a creative director. How do you use the things you learned, at Otis and picked up from Three Legged Legs and Blind? How does design enter your day-to-day life now with where you're at?
Okay. Seems like a roundabout way of asking me to cave and call myself a designer, but
I mean, that's the whole goal of this entire thing, is that at some point you will have designer somewhere on your website or your LinkedIn.
Maybe I'll just cave immediately. Maybe I am a designer. I think it depends on what you consider a designer and what design means to you. Like, mm-hmm. We design our lunch every day. We design our schedule. Like, everyone is a designer in that sense. I think I hesitate to call myself a designer because of the design community and what those expectations mm-hmm. are. And I don't think that I meet them. I'm not good with type.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that? Like, because I think that's really important, because I feel like I've had similar conversations with lots of people who are like, I'm not an artist, I'm a designer. Or, I use tools. I slide sliders and click buttons and hit render, but I'm not an artist. I feel like I've heard the same thing. For you, what do you think a capital D designer is that you don't fulfill?
Let's see. I suck at typography. I don't use grids. I think in my head when I hear design or designer, I think graphic designer, then I think like what that traditionally means. And
right.
This is probably my own, like limited thinking and limited belief and like, oh, a designer can be more than that. Like, I know that it's easy for me to see it, but not in myself, I guess, if that makes sense. So fine, Ryan, I'm a designer. now.
You're a designer, Greg. But I mean, I'm interested in this too, though, because, you know, like Camp MoGraph was a very formative thing for me, the very first one a couple of years ago, and you were there. And I had this interesting conversation at the campfire talks when I was talking. I asked these questions, and one of the big questions I asked to the crowd, to the whatever it was, 100 people there staring at me trying to like figure out what I want to say. You know, I asked like, does anyone here feel imposter syndrome? And the one thing that everybody raised their hands on when I asked three different questions that was unanimous was every single person, save for one or two, put up their hands and said, yes, I feel imposter syndrome. And I'm trying to figure out constantly since that moment, why is specifically for motion design, why do so many people feel day-to-day imposter syndrome? Like there is the everyday, I got to make something on my screen. And that's hard, right? And you got to get through that every day. And that's a little game you play with yourself and figure out how to do it. But I think at a bigger picture, there's something about the way you get into motion design, or a lot of people have gotten into motion design. Like you just said, I went to school to go to Otis to be a graphic designer and everything that meant, right? Probably print-based, probably like a lot of like elitist designers that you think in your head are like the pinnacle of what, you know, graphic design in capital letters is. And you didn't do that, right? You didn't end up becoming one of those, you know, people. But at the same time, you have an incredible amount of knowledge for design that shows up every day in your work, whether it's characters, whether it's how you deal with the client, whether it's the final look for the pieces, whether it's how you teach. You know, Greg, you have two really incredible educational products, and it's super obvious between things like that and your website that the invisible hand of someone who actually is a designer, who is trained as a designer, is at play here, right? These don't look like things that someone who came from animation, you know, just threw together. There's decisions and intent with it that it's so funny to me because I feel the same thing coming from a world where I was a 2D character animator. I went to school hoping to be able to work on feature films, drawing with a pencil, right? Like Glenn Keane is everything to me. And at the same time, I have always felt like a bit of an imposter inside motion design because I didn't accomplish my goal, right? Like I kind of felt like I forfeited, like I gave up and I resolved to just like take what I know and become a motion designer, but I didn't make it to the end goal, right? Like I'm not in that world, but every day you use what you know from design, from going to Otis by being trained as a graphic designer, the same way like 2D animation still enters into every single day, everything I do. And it feels like that's where, for some very specific reason with motion designers based on where we came from, we have the issue that, you know, like I would never tell anybody that I'm a 2D animator. I would never do that. Like, even though I love it, I do it, but that's not who I am. That's not my job title. The same way we just spent 10 minutes trying to convince you, yes, Greg, you are a designer.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. It's probably insecurity, you know, that's got to be like the root of it, which ironically is probably why I pursued a career in the arts. Also, it's everyone needs therapy. It's fine. But you know, one thing I was also thinking about was like insecurity, and also just like not like the idea that I can admit that, oh yeah, I'm good at something, you know? Like to me that ends that journey. Yes. It's like, okay, you've made it, you know? I don't want that to ever end. I don't want that at all. So I think part of me when I really think about it deep down is like if I ever just sort of say like, yeah, you know, I am a good designer. I'm like, well, then now what? You know, what am I supposed to do now? Yes. There is no longer like the story can't go on or something. And I know this sounds absolutely crazy. Like I can hear it, but I think that combined with insecurity is probably why I'm so cagey about being like, I don't know, I'm not a designer. You know, when objectively, yeah, if I look at it, I'm like, okay, color, you know, like the composition, like all these kind of like fundamental design principles, I think I have a pretty clear understanding of.
Yeah. And you can demonstrate it. You can do two things. You can demonstrate it in your work, but you're also extremely talented at explaining those things to other people in a way that changes their viewpoint on it, right? Like I know going back to Camp MoGraph, you did this really amazing. We had these breakout sessions where nobody had computers. People weren't like actively like doing what we would call work in quotations, but people were sitting down listening to people explain things, and you had pens and paper. You could draw, you could take notes. Your color session was legitimately like in my mind, the buzz of Camp MoGraph in terms of people that I know that have been working for decades, right? 10 years, 15 years. I remember EJ Hasenfratz came to me afterwards. He's like, man, you got to sit in with Greg's color session. I learned so much of what I kind of just like intuited. Like I just had a gut instinct on what works and didn't work with color, but I would just like throw stuff up and try it and it didn't work. And I'd throw it up again. Like you gave a lot of people a system and a framework for thinking about one of the biggest design fundamentals there is, right? Like what makes good color combinations? How do you find the colors that express the emotions you want to express? The way you did that live, you know, on the day was amazing. And it literally like changed people's perspectives. And now you have a really awesome, you know, product, Color for Creatives, that anybody can take that experience that lived in the day and kind of like pick it up very quickly, very easily in a way that like sticks with you. Not just like you watch a YouTube tutorial and it's like fast food. You watch it, you think about it, and then you forget about it as if you never saw it again. The way you teach is very like, it's very open and inspirational, but it also sticks. Like, when did you realize that like you can take these things that you don't even call yourself an expert on and transfer that knowledge to people in a way that's very, very like powerful?
I think I realized that just now when you told me that I have that capability.
I mean, come on, you had to have heard at Camp MoGraph, you had to hear at camp that people were like super excited that like, oh my God, this is like, it did make a really big effect on people.
You know, I don't know that I did. I think, or at least no one like came out to me afterwards and was like, that was mind blowing. I remember just having the time of my life like in those, I think there was like three workshop sessions and each one was a little different, obviously. And it was so much fun. And it was early in the morning too, if I remember. And I was just trying to get people stoked and awake and sort of like zenning out. Like we basically just used like pastel crayons and paper and like masking tape just to kind of make some fun shapes and colors and gradients. And all along the while, I'm sort of kind of lightly lecturing, saying like, well, here's all those color things, you know, like this is what's really happening and why this makes sense and why this kind of doesn't. Yeah, I think to your point about like EJ, it's like a lot of the stuff I kind of did intuitively too. I just didn't know why. I didn't understand the purpose or like the reason, I guess, like I made those decisions. And that was a big part of me pursuing color and like learning more about it. I was like, well, how does this stuff work? I don't even know what I'm doing. So I gotta like know this. No one taught me this. What do I do?
Yeah. I mean, I think not to make to stretch the Beatles metaphor even more, but I think there's a similar thing with musicians where if you don't actually read music and you weren't necessarily taught like the technicalities between, you know, why music works the way it does, but you learned it by ear, right? Like some of the best songs and some of the best musicians we all know and love in every genre, they don't read music. They don't play, you know, off of a sheet. They don't know how to, you know, denote it or record it, but they just have it instinctively from being around it, from experimenting, from just like living within it. But then you meet the people who do, right? Like I've watched this other really great documentary with Paul McCartney and Rick Rubin, where they know it, right? They understand it at like a molecular, like DNA level, why this note after this note resonates and what should come after it, right? Like it's almost in their head, they can hear it before they ever even play it. I don't think there's many people like that in motion design who can, in the moment, explain to you what design choices you need to make to get where you want to go. There's a decent amount of people who can like look at something afterwards and evaluate, oh, like look at the black and white value contrast and look at how you used foreground background and, you know, you've used gestalt theory. Like you can identify it afterwards, but there's very few people I've run into who can like formally design knowing those and utilizing those principles. Do you think there's, you know, it compared to like animation, right? Like I think a lot of people understand like the 12 principles of animation and understand what overshoot and understand what appeal and, you know, like those things are, and they think about it when they're working. Do you think there's a way, or there's something we can do just as an industry to get people to consider the fundamentals of design and their process as much as we do with animation? Is there's something, a different way we could be talking about it? Or like I struggle with trying to like convince people that design is as powerful of a tool set as Houdini or that cool After Effects plugin, but it's almost like design is its own piece of software.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, when you were making that That Beatles analogy. Okay, I really do think you love the Beatles, Ryan. It's okay. You can admit
yes,
that.
I do. You're a designer. Yeah, exactly. And I love the Beatles. Totally. And we can both admit it.
No, you know what? I was thinking, I was like, you know, do I really think about that stuff when I'm working? Like in the moment, am I being like, oh, mm-hmm. well, I should do this? And, you know, like applying the principles. I don't know that I do. I think part of, you know, what do they call that? The curse of knowledge, where it's like, if you know too much, you kind of become paralyzed and you really don't know what to do. Versus a novice, let's call them, they have no idea what is right or wrong about what they're doing. They just jump in and do it. Like, you know, there's something really, really great about that. And I suppose all creative work, not just design, is striking that balance of like making sure, you know, there's something that makes sense and that you're doing it right, but also that you're kind of letting, I'm going to get all woo-woo, but letting like creativity and ideas flow through you and, you know, like onto the page, onto the screen and whatever, and sort of turning off somewhat of that analytical side of your brain and making sure that it sort of feels right too. I think mm-hmm. one side or the other gets really boring, but like mm-hmm. being able to strike the balance between the two, I think is where like the real magic happens.
Well, I mean, I definitely agree. Like you said, you can paralyze yourself from trying to make sure everything. I know a lot of film directors who start off on a project, and in the first couple of days shooting, they are thinking about every single specific like little bit of compositional analysis and where the, you know, depth of field is at and exactly what the color temperature is. And then about 3, 4, 5 days into a 2-week shoot, all that goes out the window, because if you spend that much time analyzing every single movement or click or decision or placement, you're never going to get anything done, right? Like at some point you hope you build up enough momentum that your prep and your experience takes over, and then it turns into instinct and you can go. I think that's probably really true for young designers that are starting to try to like build momentum in their career. Can we just talk a little bit about something that I'm super excited about, it because your sense of color, awesome. I love your Illustration for Designers product. I think it's a very good complement to a course we actually sell, in the sense that there's a lot of people who draw. There's a lot of people who have fun drawing, but they don't see what they do for fun or in a sketchbook as something that's very commercial or ready for a client. And I think what both our course and especially what your Illustration for Designers product does is it teaches people how to think in a way that you can draw and you can apply that to your day-to-day, right? I love that. But one thing I've always been dying for someone to do, and I've always thought you were a great person to potentially do this, is that people who've listened to me talk for the last few years at School of Motion, one of my pet peeves is how there has somehow become a house style for character design in motion design. And you know what I'm talking about, right? Like everybody has the same proportions, the little black triangles underneath their neck and their armpits, and everything looks like the same person designed 90% of the character work in motion design. And I've been dying for someone to break that, have something I could point people to, like, hey, if you want to do something different, here it is. And Greg, lo and behold, mid-January, you're hosting something called the Character Design Workshop, which I am signing up for and I will be there. tell us all about, like, where did this idea come from? What's it going to be like? And what can we expect to learn from sitting in on this workshop?
Yeah, for sure. Character Design Workshop is something I've wanted to do for a really long time. I don't know about anyone else out there, but like I go through a lot of phases where I'm like really into something for a while, and then I like will move on and do something else, you know, for like a couple months and whatever. And that's sort of been my life, along with a series of bad haircuts. Mm-hmm. But there's a handful of things that have been just like the through line with my life and, you know, what I'm interested in, like heavy metal. I don't know. I just love it. And another one is characters. And I attribute that to, you know, Saturday morning cartoons and all, you know, growing up with all that stuff and games. So understanding character design and doing a workshop about it is, I'm like, I got to do that. Like, I don't know what it is mm-hmm. yet, but I have to do that. And it's December now, but last month I decided, I'm like, okay, I need to come up with a workshop. So I'm going to do it about character design. And full disclosure, I'm working on it right now. I have like a rough outline. I know what I want it to be, but there's also a reality. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's probably going to be just a few hours, so I can't, you know, we can't do everything, but my goal for that workshop is to get everyone drawing and at least being comfortable with the idea of designing their own character and and set yourself up for success. You know, so we're going to cover just some like fundamentals of like, how do you put a character together? You know, how do proportions work? And also, like, more importantly, the idea that anything can be a character. It doesn't have to look like concept art. It doesn't have to look like a Pixar sketch. You don't even need to know like underlying form and structure of, you know, like the human figure. That's all really good stuff. Don't get me wrong. Like, if you really want to pursue that, definitely check that out. But that's not what this workshop is. This workshop is about having fun and learning how to make your own character, no matter what it looks like, and being comfortable doing that. And then hopefully after the workshop, with what you've learned, and I'll probably leave a little takeaway, you can continue to explore that. And hopefully that will be sort of the entry point into, you know, like learning more about character design for people.
You have a line here that could be a line from a Beatles song. But you have this line that says, a square, a squiggle, a single little pixel. I love the idea that anything can be a character. You don't have to be an expert draftsman, but you do need to understand how to create something that people empathize with or that people associate through charm and appeal. You know, those fundamentals of animation design also apply to motion design, but it's not one set of rules, right? It's not just like, okay, the head needs to be this size and it needs to be, the body needs to be five, you know, heads tall for it to be able to be appealing. The eyes have to be, like, again, you can get into what we just talked about. Even something that should just be as fun as doodling a character, you can go down the rabbit hole of like, this is the 12 steps to making a perfect character. That I'm excited that this is not going to be that. Yep.
No way. I am not that good. There are people who are so much better at that stuff. So yeah, I'm not gonna do that.
But you know, I go back to this though, Greg, is that that's what makes motion design so interesting, is that it doesn't have to be that. Like, we can be informed by the, you know, 95 years of history of Disney style animation, or we can be informed by anime or manga or any great illustrators we love, but motion design has a different set of expectations. Like, if you go to watch a Disney film or a Pixar film, there's an expectation of what it has to hit in terms of like a level of like production quality and draftsmanship, and you know what to expect from a story. And if it doesn't hit that, there's something wrong with it. There's something strange. But I just did a really cool podcast with Sarah Beth Morgan and Taylor Yontz and Rebecca Hamilton about their, they have a short film coming out called Between Lines. And it does not, it is animated with the same level of craftsmanship as, you know, any other animated feature or short, but it feels like something that could only come from motion design because the rules are different. The expectations are different coming from our side of the like creative arts. That I love this idea that, like, you know, you don't have to spend, you know, 4 years at a school and interning at a major studio to be able to design a character that can be animated well and tell a story. You can take what you already know and use the things that you use day to day in a way that makes things look different and might catch people's attention in a totally different way.
Totally. Yeah. Characters are just, they're little like storytelling vessels. That's all they are. They're supposed to be, you know, they're supposed to make you feel something. And that's what a story does. So a square can make you feel a lot of things.
I love that. I love that as like the core idea behind this. Okay, so tell us, where this is called The Character Design with Greg Gunn. Where can people go to sign up for this, and when should we expect to be signing up for this?
Yeah, so I don't know when this episode will come out, but the workshops themselves, there's two. They're on January 12th and January 13th. One in the AM, one in the PM, and you can sign up right now. Hopefully, still it's available.
Sounds awesome. And we will include the link here everywhere you might find this podcast. But I think I'll be signing up for the second one in the PM. So if you want to take a drawing class and see my smiling face, I will be there on the second day, the one that happens at night. Greg, thank you so much. I always love talking to you. I'm glad that we got you down on the podcast. And yes, my name is Ryan Summers and I'm a Beatles fan. And your name is Greg Gunn. And yes, you are a designer.
Yeah, all right, I guess.
Cool. Thank you, Greg. Thank you so much for the time.
Oh, I appreciate it, Ryan. Thanks a lot for having me.
I'm so stoked that I got to spend some time with Greg Gunn. You got to hear us talk about all kinds of things. Probably a little bit too much about the Beatles, but yes, Greg Gunn is a designer. And if you're listening to this, you can be too. Design fundamentals are really the software that drives every single decision we make. And as cool as it is to learn new tools and learn new techniques and pick up things like VR and AR and all that stuff that's out there that's super exciting, every button press, every decision you make is informed by what you know about design, which is again why I really wanted you to hear from Greg Gunn and understand how he brings design into his everyday activities. So, as always, here at School of Motion, we are here to inspire you, introduce you to new people, and just show you what's on the horizon for the world of motion design. Until next time, peace.